morning is taken from the Old Testament text. It is one of a series of two connected sermons, but this morning we're going to deal with the Old Testament text as it leads up into the next sermon. When you go to buy something in the United States, generally speaking, you enter a store, and the products you are looking for are laid out on shelves, and there are prices connected to them. And to be honest, it's a fairly subdued kind of affair. You go in to buy, the prices are put before you, you buy for the prices, or you don't if it's too much. But generally speaking, there is not a whole lot of passion and fire connected to the process. In the third world, that is definitely not so. I was reminded of that many months ago this year when I was in Nassau. And as the entire city lives off of tourists, their merchants are very aggressive. The third world market is very different. There are people everywhere selling many things, and they are aggressive in their salesmanship. There are many merchants selling the same things, and they want you to buy from them, not from someone else. And so there's real aggressiveness taking place. They will show you their goods and explain why their goods are better than their buddy's goods, even though they're obviously the same. It's actually quite fun to buy in such a market, and there's haggling that goes on, and there's life. The merchants have their job to do, and they are passionate about it. In our Old Testament reading today, we have just such a marketplace, which would have been common for the first hearers of Solomon. They would have bought their goods and traded their goods in just such a place, and so they would be very familiar with the imagery that he works. This marketplace is even described as being in, quote, a city. In chapter 9, verse 3, and in chapter 9, verse 14, Solomon points to the fact that all this mercantile business is taking place in, quote, the city. But the city here is probably not like Nassau or like Manila, where I have been in marketplaces. The city seems to be a symbol for the world of men that we live in, the interrelated, the interconnected world of men. It corresponds to John's use of the word, the world, the word that we read with such joy when we read John 3:16 and hear, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life." And yet, nevertheless, it is a city, a world, that is passing away. The city will not remain forever. The world is going to go. The same John who recorded Jesus' words saying, "For God so loved the world," and such, also wrote, "Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lusts of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the world is passing away, and the lust of it. But he who does the will of God abides forever." The city, or the world, if you want to use John's word, is where we live and move and have our being, paradoxically. That phrase was used of God the Father, and so we do live and move and have our being in him. But at the same time, in this world, we live and move and have our being in a set of interrelational attachments we have with other men. Men we don't even really know. We live in a world of people, says my grandmother. And even though I may not know 99% of them, their existence impacts my existence. And I live according to a very complex set of mores because they exist. I relate to them, they relate to me, and we both relate in certain ways that we expect the other to relate in because the city requires it. The interconnectedness of man regulates it. If I don't live according to those mores, if I do something that is unexpected to those mores, I may very well be taken for insane, and I may very well be. Because man is created to live in the city, to live in relationship to people, and my thinking, my acting, my entire way of life is impacted day in and day out because I dwell in this city with other people. It's not just Christians, it's not just the Spirit of God in the Bible who speaks of this city. Thinkers through all ages have recognized living in the city. All you have to do is see some of the best works that have ever appeared on TV or movie screens. Shows like The Prisoner or movies like Dark City. Or read a book like The Social Contract. And you will see unbelievers talking about life in the city. You can't get away from it. It is something that we are truly in and we will be in until the day we die. Many have tried to get away from the city. That's actually where the monastic movement came from. People who said, I will go and live with a small community of Christians and I will be free from the city, but it did not work and it never will. Wherever you have people living in some sort of relationship to one another, there is the city and you can't get away from it. Arguably, even if you were to live in a cave by yourself, you, as a human being, would take the city with you. It is just where we're going to live to the day we die. And in the streets of the marketplace of the city, there are people who want to sell you something all the time. I'm amazed at how the writings of Solomon are so practical some of the time. Solomon in chapter 20 of the book of Proverbs and verse 14 spoke of the haggling that took place in the marketplace. He writes, quote, it is good for nothing, cries the buyer, but when he has gone his way, then he boasts. They're definitely the way people work. It's not worth it. It's not worth your price. Cut it in half. But then once you've got your deal, you go and tell all your buddies what a great deal you got in the marketplace. Solomon is not thinking about that kind of selling, though. Because his city is a symbol and because his marketplace is a symbol, he is thinking more of those who are selling spiritual goods and estates. And just like human beings are selling physical stuff all the time, human beings are selling spiritual thoughts, conditions, doctrines, worldviews all the time. We're in the bustling marketplace and we are being sold a bunch of goods and it hits us over and over again from all kinds of sources. I could go through the sources, but it would be sort of cliche. You know them. You live in the world as much as I do. And messages bombard us. Buy this, buy that, buy into this, buy into that. In Solomon's marketplace, he presents two big houses of business. Apparently, they run pretty much everything happening in the marketplace. Everything goes back to them eventually. There are two women who are selling things in this marketplace. They are good at what they do, and they do sell. Believe you me, they are merchants, first rate. And they want you to buy in to what they are selling. The first merchant woman is Lady Wisdom. She is offering bread and wine and also life and understanding. It is what she has to sell. She is offering it. Then there is the foolish woman, as the King James put it. There is an issue of textual criticism, is my understanding, but this probably doesn't relate merely to a foolish woman, but to a spiritual merchant woman, much like Lady Folly. The way many of the English translations put it make it a bit clearer. They read, the woman's stupidity is boisterous, so simple that she knoweth not what she would do. Or, Dame Folly acts on impulse, is childish and knows nothing. Or, The woman folly is riotous. She is thoughtlessness and knoweth nothing. Folly is loud and alluring. She knows no sense of shame. You get the idea. She is the parallel to Lady Wisdom, and she too has a merchant house, and she too is involved in business in this marketplace, and they are the big guns. And every day, they are selling us something. How do you feel when someone is trying to sell you something? How do you respond? I have a feeling, given my audience, given that that's the world you live and move and have your being in, you become somewhat jaded. You know that when someone is selling you something, you do not immediately bite. But to be honest, if someone is selling something, you don't immediately close your mind and say, no, this person is selling me something. That would be impractical. That's not the way the world works. People do sell things, and you do too. You want them to buy, but you're not wanting to take advantage of them. You're wanting to sell them a better truck. You're wanting to sell them better merchandise. You're wanting to give them a good experience for their money. So are many other merchants. If you were to be totally closed-minded when somebody tries to sell you something, you would lose out. But if you are totally open-minded, you will lose out as well. You'll become a sucker, because believe it or not all advertising is true. The fact of the matter is, most people in this marketplace are neither closed-minded or open-minded. They are empty-minded. They are the ultimate in open-minded in a totally negative sense. There is nothing going on in their mind. All this advertisement is hitting them. All these aggressive merchants are selling them something, and the depth of their thinking is, do my socks match? The lights are on, but not much is happening. The text says as much, actually. Both great merchant ladies are selling to an audience they describe as, quote, the simple, end quote. The Shakers, that non-Christian cult that actually flourished in our area for a time, have a very famous song. "'Tis a gift to be simple, 'tis a gift to be free, 'tis a gift to turn around and end up where you should be," or what have you. When we think of being simple, I don't know about you, but that song begins to play in my head because I'm just kind of triggered to it. But the song is 100% wrong. It is not a gift to be simple, especially the way Solomon is using the term. To be simple is to be vaguely aware that you don't really know much about really important things, and not really to care much that you don't know much about really important things. It is not to be ignorant, because the ignorant may be students and they may learn. It is to be what we describe in Jackson County as ignorant. It's to be willfully dumb. And both women, both spirits moving in this marketplace, they are selling to the simple. Lady Wisdom, though, is not really completely known for her patience with them. At the beginning of this book, we met her, and she describes some of her selling technique to the simple. It does not last forever. In chapter 1 of Proverbs, beginning at verse 20, this is what we read of Lady Wisdom. "Wisdom calls aloud outside. She raises her voice in the open squares. She cries out in the chief concourses, and at the opening of the gates of the city, she speaks her words. How long, you simple ones," there's our term again, "will you love simplicity? For scorners delight in their scorning, and fools hate knowledge." And there you see that being simple is no gift, because to be simple begins to develop you into a scorner. It begins to develop you into a fool. Lady Wisdom hates that. "Turn at my reproof," she says. "Surely I will pour my spirit on you. I will make my words known to you. Because I have called and you refused, I have stretched out my hand and no one regarded, because you disdained all my counsel and would have none of my reproof, I also will laugh at your calamity. I will mock when your terror comes. When your terror comes like a storm and your destruction comes like a whirlwind, when distress and anguish come upon you, then they will call on me, but I will not answer. They will seek me diligently, but they will not find me, because they hated knowledge and did not choose the fear of the Lord. They would have none of my counsel and despised all my reproof. Therefore they shall eat the fruit of their own way and be filled to the full with their own fancies. For the turning away of the simple, and that's ultimately what they're doing, will slay them, and the complacency of fools will destroy them. But whoever listens to me will dwell safely and will be secure without the fear of evil. Maybe somebody should give Lady Wisdom some tips in being winsome in her salesmanship. She's going to lose some customers that way, talking like that. But what can you do? They're selling to the simple. It's an interesting audience. By the end of the day, however, these two women will have those from the marketplace in their houses. By the time the gates close and the buying and selling are over, they will have split them up, one to one house and one to another. Those who enter Folly's house receive quite a number of things. She is a merchant, after all, and she is selling a bill of goods, and they partake. I have a list of everything that they end up with. They end up with a hate of Lady Wisdom and all who have acted on her behalf. You can see that in verse 7. They despise wisdom, knowledge, that sort of thing. They are emboldened in their scoffing. They are simple, but who really needs to know important things? Who needs to really be wise? Who needs to really think deeply? That just adds wrinkles to your face. It just adds a furrow to your brow. Who really needs that heavy stuff? They end up without the fear of the Lord. That is a good that they do not buy. In fact, they don't understand the Lord at all, says Solomon. They have no fear of him or any understanding that would lead to understanding him. When a customer of Lady Folly is talking to you of the Lord, when they describe him, when they put their ideas about him to you and question his motives, if a good God were to exist, why does he do this or why does he do that? According to Solomon, they have been in Lady Folly's house and they have no understanding of him, so their questions really are non-intelligible at all. But that is, in fact, what they purchased. They're merely getting their money's worth. They don't find wisdom. They don't find understanding. Wisdom is being skillful. In fact, it's sometimes used for trades. If you're good under a truck, for instance, you could be said to be wise with a mechanical skill. But usually it's used of being good at being good. It's used at being able to obey God's law and do it really well and therefore profit from it, which suggests that it's possible to be on the side of the angels and to be inept at being good. Think about that for a second. Maybe you even can think of people who would qualify for that. Understanding is having an idea of why things take place as they do. Those people who wander the marketplace wondering about their matching socks, they really have no idea why anything's happening in the world at all. They're okay with that, but really you have to wonder what it would be like to go through life with that kind of mush in your head. They don't have any understanding. But what they do have is they have stolen goods. And they have water that doesn't really belong to them. And they have bread eaten in secret. That kind of imagery suggests two things. It suggests titillation, because who doesn't enjoy what is done behind a locked door where no one sees? But it also suggests shame at the very same time. They receive their money's worth, but they are ashamed to actually eat it in public. Right now, Carmen is reading through Alexander Schultz and Nietzsche's book, The Gulag Archipelago, that's right. There was a character in there this week who was an interrogator for the state. He performed terrible acts. He tortured, hurt, and maimed other people. That was his job. But he lived in utter fear that his wife would find out what he was doing at work. Because he knew that if she knew that he was like that, it would tear her up. It would rip her apart. And the last thing he wanted to do was hurt his wife, even though he hurt many other people's lives. The last thing he wanted to do was break her heart. So she didn't know what her husband did. She thought he was a well-liked, well-respected policeman serving the state, not knowing that the respect was fear and his acts were cruel. He partook of bread and wine in secret. He did not want his real life to be known, because his wife would be hurt. They end up joining the truly dead. Everyone dies, of course, but in Lady Folly's house, you're more than dead. The true dead end up in her market stalls. They never leave. They embrace death because they end up in hell, says the text. At the end of the day, when the gates are closed and the buying and selling is over, if you have become a good customer of Lady Folly, you'll never go back to the marketplace again because you will be in hell then. Those who enter into Wisdom's house, though, they also partake of goods, and the goods are very different. The first thing I note is that the goods they buy are genuine articles. Solomon does a masterful job of describing that as he describes Lady Wisdom's stall. She has carved out her pillars where she serves from, and in fact, her goods have been prepared by her own hands. Lady Folly, her goods were not prepared by her hands, they were stolen. She didn't really make them or earn them, and when you get them, they're hot. But Lady Wisdom has slaughtered her meat, she's mixed her wine, she has created. She is a producer. And she, in fact, describes what that production was like before she opened her marketplace in chapter 8 of Proverbs, beginning in the 22nd verse. There she reads about being around before any of her clientele was, only God. And we read, "The Lord possessed me at the beginning of his way, before his works of old. I have been established from everlasting, from the beginning, before there was ever an earth. When there were no depths, I was brought forth. When there were no fountains abounding with water, before the mountains were settled, before the hills, I was brought forth. While as yet he had not made the earth or the fields or the primeval dust of the world. When he prepared the heavens, I was there. When he drew a circle on the face of the deep, when he established the clouds above, when he strengthened the fountains of the deep, when he assigned to the sea its limit, so that the waters would not transgress his command, when he marked out the foundations of the earth, then I was beside him as a master craftsman, and I was daily his delight, rejoicing always before him, rejoicing in his inhabited world, and my delight was with the sons of men." It's always kind of a privilege and a thrill to meet a salesman who has actually made their own goods. There's something kind of honorable about that, something noteworthy, and Lady Wisdom is certainly that way. She was involved in creation. She sells bread and wine, as I said before, which is not the most exciting of goods, but they are the nourishment a man needs to get through the day. They are the meal that undergirds human labor. In fact, the meal that has undergirded most of what man has done for most of his run on earth, it's the kind of stuff that sticks with you. It's the kind of stuff that gives you life that you can produce. And in fact, the next thing I notice about Lady Wisdom's stall is she says she actually is giving life. It's quite the good. But now she attaches it to forsaking foolishness. The word is the same in Hebrew as folly, just a slight different construction. She gives the good of life, but you do have to buy certain things. There has to be an exchange. And in this case, foolishness and life cannot be had in the same traveling bag. They will not sit side by side. The person who buys a Lady Wisdom's stall develops in the way of understanding, she says. Lady Folly offers a get it now, you'll have it totally kind of deal, but again, perhaps Lady Wisdom could use some study in her salesmanship technique, because she says that if you buy from her, it takes you a while to get her gifts and make them work. But then Solomon talked about that too on the way to our passage. In Proverbs chapter 4, beginning in verse 18, we read this. The path of the just is like the shining sun that shines ever brighter into the perfect day. So for the just, it's kind of like the sun rising and coming up and growing in light. It starts off very small, a sliver, but then as the day goes on, you get more of it, and finally you're in the full orb day. The way of the wicked, however, is like darkness. They do not know what makes them stumble. You kind of have to practice with these goods. It develops over time. But then there is an amazing transformation from buying at Lady Wisdom's shop. Those who are simple, just as simple as who Lady Folly sells to, they become wise and just men. They actually develop the skill of being good at being good. They become just, which means they have a working knowledge of what righteousness is supposed to be and do. That is quite the transformation from being simple. The simple giggle at the thought of actually knowing anything important, at the possibility of being anything important, but in Lady Wisdom's shop, people change. Although they do bear the brunt of the violence that is done in the marketplace. Proverbs 9 has a cutout in it. After we read about Lady Wisdom selling her goods, and before we get to Folly, she gives a long diatribe of what her customers will be like. And if you read it and think about it, it's kind of a warning. The foolish hate wisdom, and they also hate everyone who bears it. In the marketplace of ideas, those who are going to shop at Lady Folly's house really despise those who are going to shop at Lady Wisdom's house. It's kind of like what we saw in the marketplace these last 2 weeks. There were two companies in the news selling things. There was a certain chicken company whose owners had in fact stood up for certain principles. And then there was a coffee company that had stood up for exactly opposite principles. And both of them said to their customers, come in here. We are the exact opposite of those out there. The chicken company stood up for biblical principles. The coffee company stood up for unrighteousness. And they invited everyone who was listening to them, come to our shop. Come buy from us. But if you come into our shop, you're saying you don't like what the other shop stands for. Well, that's perfectly fine, actually. That's perfectly okay. Lady Wisdom and Lady Folly are doing the same thing in the world all the time. And those who shop at Lady Folly's shop hate those who shop at Lady Wisdom's shop. And Lady Wisdom warns her clientele that. If you rebuke a mocker, if you rebuke the simple, they will hate you. They might even hit you, says the text. It's one or the other. It cannot be both. Although with that bread and wine and life and understanding, you also do get the fear of the Lord. You also get an understanding of the Lord so that if you talk about God, it's not nonsensical. That's kind of important. God actually permits the clientele of Lady Wisdom to actually know Him to a degree and to grow in that knowledge, so that when they talk about the Lord, it is very, very different than when Lady Folly's clientele do. The Didache, which I read some months ago, talked about that, where the more established church told the newer church, now where the converted saints talk about the Lord, there the Lord is. when the older saints in the church get together and they're talking about the good things of God, you should be there too, because when they talk about God, God actually shows up. That's quite a good to be boss. They get wisdom, they get knowledge, they get understanding. I have one of the verses from our chapter as the head, as the tagline to one of my websites that I post to, that and also Proverbs 1 verse 7, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. I put it there as a testimony that you really have to shop at Lady Wisdom's shop before you can know anything else. You really are not prepared to know anything about anything else unless you have the fear of the Lord. That's where wisdom comes from, understanding comes from, and even knowledge. Are you well trained in your discipline? Are you an excellent mechanic? Are you an excellent biologist? Are you a fantastic computer programmer? Are you a magnificent farmer? The truth is, you're doing it wrong. If you don't have wisdom and understanding and knowledge, you cannot be doing it right. So to shop at Lady Wisdom's house is a foundation for further learning. It is an epistemological floor, if you will. I find it kind of interesting, by the way, that Lady Wisdom has to send out her maidens into the marketplace to invite people into her house. Lady Folly didn't have to do that. There's nothing about her sending out her maids. You know, it may be that Lady Folly has a better rapport with her customers. It may be that by word of mouth, her shop is already better advertised, and people are ready to go to her shop. But then our text did say that she herself was a simpleton, and she's selling the simpletons. Lady Wisdom is not. She is exactly the opposite, and so she has to send maidens out to cry to invite people into her house. She is at something of a disadvantage. But she gives longer life, says the text. The implication is for this world, but it's also for the world to come. Actually, shopping at Lady Wisdom's shop might shorten your life in this life, but you don't join the dead. You get life, so in the world to come, life is yours forever. And then, ironically, the last verse describing Lady Wisdom says, you just generally profit. You benefit. Which is incredible irony, because that's the sales pitch of Lady Folly. Come enjoy stolen water, come enjoy stolen foods, profit. But Lady Wisdom's good actually lets you profit. Such is the possibilities of the city's marketplace. In our Old Testament reading, our ladies are spirits. They're not really physical people. They're at work in the city. In fact, they're at work in pretty much everything happening in it. But they are not tangible beings to really talk to. During the time of Solomon, you would see Lady Wisdom at work in natural revelation. You would hear her voice in special revelation. But in the New Testament, she does gain a much better salesman. In 1 Corinthians, when Paul wrote to the church at Corinth, in the first chapter in the 30th verse, he says this, of him you are in Christ Jesus, who became for us wisdom from God, and righteousness and sanctification and redemption. Lady Wisdom has always been crying in the marketplace. She will be to the end of time. But something has changed with the coming of Jesus Christ. He has embodied all her goods. He is, in fact, wisdom to be had for believers. We are able to see wisdom far better than Solomon's original audience. In Solomon's text, wisdom is personified, but it's an attribute of God. I read Lady Wisdom speaking of that. She said, the Lord possessed me. And of course, the word wisdom means the skill of being good at being good. It's not a picture of a separate spiritual being, an angel, if you will. It's important to note that because there have been those who have purported to worship Lady Wisdom, calling her Sophia. She is not a real being. She is an attribute of God. And in fact, Jesus Christ really embodies her. The reason why some have called for worshiping her is because they have said there is no feminine aspect to our Christian religion, but that is not true. The Apostle John writes to the church in 2 John and says, "The elder to the elect lady and her children, whom I love in truth, and not only I, but also all those who have known the truth, because of the truth which abides in us and will be with us forever. Grace, mercy, and peace will be with you from God the Father and from the Lord Jesus Christ, the Son of the Father, in truth and love. I rejoice greatly that I have found some of your children walking in the truth, as we receive commandment from the Father. And now I plead with you, lady, not as though I wrote a new commandment to you." John is talking about the gathered saints, the church, in very feminine language. And well, it should be. When the church assembles, you're with your mom. The feminine aspect of the religion is the fact that the church is our mother, just as much as God is our father. And the mother is there to care for us, to tenderly love us, to train us, to help us learn to walk, to feed us. That is your feminine aspect. Wisdom is an attribute. It is fairly feminine. Wives are described as being helpmeets to their husbands. And the word is actually a loan word from Persian, which talks about being an advisor to the king. Pretty cool gig if you can get it, a fairly decent job. You're not the king, but you have to have wisdom and insight to advise the king, and kings are fools if they do not listen to their advisors. They may not take every word the advisor says, but you are there to advise. It's feminine, and yet we are told of wise men, and even when we see wisdom perfectly embodied, it's a man, it's Jesus of Nazareth, but it is kind of a feminine characteristic. Wisdom is God's character, though, and he is no female. We will hear more about the marketplace of ideas. We will see more of the handiwork of Lady Wisdom and Folly when next we assemble to study God's Word. But for now, I would invite you to remember this image. Lady Wisdom and Lady Folly are constantly trying to sell you something. Now, after the cross and the open tomb, the greatest salesman of Lady Wisdom is Jesus, but you are always in sight of their words. Consider well what you buy in the marketplace. The goods are not the same. They are of very different quality. Let the buyer beware.